From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The world of robots in love and war. Hello again, I'm Aaron Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Google is buying up robotics firms. Amazon's predicting home deliveries by drone. The recent film Her depicts a romance with an operating system. Robots are finding their way into workplaces, homes, and popular culture, so it's hard not to imagine they'll penetrate our emotional lives as well. The interaction of humans and robots has become a serious study. When do they help? When do they get in the way? Who's responsible for their actions? Do we need a new code of ethics for dealing with robots? Today's talking point, the Waldorf method from Europe, makes an appearance in the schools of China. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, I'm Aaron Alney, back with To the Point. Robots are here to stay, in factories and homes, from real-world battlefields to popular culture. On this program, we'll talk about robotics and the increased interaction of robots with human beings. Today's talking point, Chinese students may outrank their peers in the United States and Europe, but there's still a parental backlash against state-run education. We'll hear how the Waldorf method from 20th century Europe is catching on in China. First, this news update. Failure is not an option. So says the Association of Clean Air Agencies about President Obama's promise to use his executive authority when it comes to climate change. The staff of the EPA is struggling to regulate America's 1,500 power plants to impact the environment and to avoid lawsuits. Coral Davenport reports for the New York Times. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren.
You report about legislative language, that's what this is all about, and how it can't be either too loose or too stringent. Tell us what the consequences of those things would be.
So the EPA is laboring right now to write these climate change regulations, but they've never really done anything like this before. They do have the legal authority to write these regulations. But they don't really have a lot of guidance on how to do it. If they make the regulations too tight and aggressive, they could have a really big impact on the environment, but they could also be very legally vulnerable. It's expected that they will probably be hit with dozens of lawsuits. It's very likely that the lawsuits could go to the Supreme Court. If the regulations are too tight, they could also have the impact of shuttering hundreds of power plants very quickly. Without new electricity coming online to replace them, it could lead to power outages. It could lead to real problems in the energy system. If they write the regulations too loosely, they might not come under all of these legal attacks, but they might not end up having a significant environmental impact. So there's a lot of pressure on these EPA lawyers to get this rule right, because it will have tremendous economic and environmental consequences.
You describe hundreds of meetings with state officials, environmentalists, and utilities as well as they try to work all of this out.
Yes. What folks at EPA are telling me is that the efforts going on to write these regulations are perhaps unprecedented in the history of the agency. They've never I've been told that in the past few months there have been over 200 meetings with all of the stakeholders as they try to write these regulations. They are meeting, as you say, with state officials, with electric utilities, with environmental groups. They're trying to get as much legal input as they can as they try to prepare these regulations. They know that industry and states are almost certain to sue them when they write these regulations, so they're trying to do as much outreach as they can, even though they know they're going to be sued. They're reaching out to these parties and saying, look, we're going to write these regulations whether you like it or not. Can we try to find a way to work together? Can we try to find some common ground as we go forward? So, I'm hearing that both the effort both behind the scenes as they try to craft these regulations, and the public outreach is really unprecedented. These are going to be huge regulations, and they're trying very hard to get it right.
Unprecedented, huge, and those are certainly appropriate words when you consider that what we're talking about is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States.
Yes, and that is coal-fired power plants are the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. There are just over 600 of them, and these will be the real target of these regulations. And again, if the regulations work, if they're effective, we will probably see the closure of hundreds of those power plants, of those coal-fired power plants, over the coming years, which could trigger a fundamental change in the broader U.S. energy economy, where we get our energy, how we get our energy, how it's delivered, how much it costs. And you know, this is if the president wants to go after climate change, wants to attack climate change, those coal-fired power plants are the sort of the number one target.
40% of the nation's electricity is involved in this, but as you point out, states including Kentucky and Ohio and Missouri rely on coal for 80% to 90% of their power. So if they aren't able to make the transition to renewables in time, they're going to be in big trouble.
And that's why I think the EPA is reaching out in particular to those states. They do anticipate heavy pushback. Already, the state of Nebraska has filed a lawsuit against the EPA about these climate regulations even before they finalized. EPA sees that as a preview of what it expects of dozens of lawsuits yet to come. What's also really hard is that President Obama has given EPA an incredibly tight timeline to finish these regulations. He wants to get as much done as possible before he leaves office. So the timeline he's given is for a draft regulation on existing power plants by June 1st of this year, a final regulation by June of 2015, and then states will have 1 year to come up with compliance plans. But typically, states say that they have 2 to 3 years to come up with such compliance plans. So this is a really hard regulation, and they're trying to do it in a much tighter time frame than usual in order to get as much done as possible before Obama leaves office.
Real test for the EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy, who used to work for Mitt Romney. Coral Davenport with the New York Times, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
In a moment, the world of robots in love and war on To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with an archived edition of To the Point. Remember Hal? The first conversation between a human being and a robot might well have happened in 1968 in Stanley Kubrick's iconic film 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Now, robots are a part of daily life, from factories to more and more homes. But robotics often starts with the military. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, is running a contest for robotic emergency responders. Google, Apple, Amazon, and many other companies already are deeply involved and invested in robotic technology. Mike Davin is editor at thebusinessofrobotics.com. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
How is it that all of a sudden we're hearing so much about robots?
Well, I think it's been building for a little while. You know, there's been a confluence of factors, and the technology has reached a point, and the expense associated with it has reached a point where all kinds of exciting things are happening all at once.
Well, tell us about some of them.
Sure. Well, you mentioned in the intro the DARPA Robotics Challenge. That's an example of the, you know, most cutting-edge robots that have ever been built competing against each other. It was inspired by the nuclear disaster in Japan a couple years ago, when they didn't want to send humans into a situation like that because of the radiation and things like that. And they realized, okay, maybe we're at a point where we can have robots do it. So they'll be competing in 8 different challenges, and the robots that perform the best will move on to the finals, which will be next year.
What about Google and Apple and Amazon?
Well, they're all examples that have sort of validated the fact that robotics is one of the next big things. You know, people compare it to the dot-com boom. But, you know, in terms of exactly what they're doing with their technology, hard to say. You know, they're pretty secretive, but there have obviously been a lot of startups and even more established companies like Boston Dynamics, which is the company that built a lot of the robots for that robotics challenge and which was just purchased by Google, getting bought up. So it's just an exciting time for the industry.
And speaking of the technology, let's go back for a moment to the DARPA competition for first responders, I guess you could say, people who have to go into nuclear power plants. It's called humanoid. What does that mean?
Humanoid. So that means looks like a person. Robots like that are very difficult to build, but they have some advantages, which is that these type of robots can use all the same tools that people can use. So, for instance, one of the challenges in the DARPA challenge is for the robot to get into a sort of a car, kind of an ATV-type vehicle, but and drive it around. So the idea is that that way we don't have to have specialized tools for the robots. They can take advantage of all the same things that the human responders would use, and they can also go upstairs and open doors and use firefighter tools and all that sort of thing.
So how likely is it that they're going to come up with a robot from this competition that can, in fact, act like a human being in the ways that you describe?
Well, the competition, which is open to the public, and there'll be videos, I'm sure, being released shortly afterwards, what you'll see is that the robots, while they're very advanced and involve all kinds of technology that's never been tried before, they move very slowly. It almost looks like they're moving in slow motion because the things that we take for granted doing, like turning a valve or opening a door, requires a lot of difficult, vision systems and robot hands are very difficult to build. And so what you'll see is that this is kind of a first step in that direction, but if people are thinking that, these are going to be like something out of science fiction, it's not quite there yet.
Where do we see the most sophisticated robots now?
Well, a lot's been going on. It's sort of happening in all different segments. One segment that's interesting to talk about is factory automation. Traditional robots, what you think about as robots and where robots have been for decades, are in factories. So you've seen them on auto assembly lines and electronics manufacturing. And those are very big robots, very expensive, usually in cages, because they were too dangerous for people to be around. Because of advances in technology, we're getting to a point now where we can make robots that are safe to work alongside humans and which are also quite a bit less expensive. The most prominent example that came out just about a year ago is a robot called Baxter, which looks kind of like a person. It's got two hands and a little face. The face looks kind of like an iPad with a face on it. And that robot was designed by a company called Rethink Robotics out of Massachusetts. The guy who founded it is one of the co-founders of iRobot, which is the company behind the Roomba vacuum cleaner. That is one of the robots that's kind of all over the country right now. What makes Baxter different is that it's very simple to program. It can work side by side with people, so there's no cage necessary. People can teach it what to do just by moving the arms instead of by sitting in a computer terminal with, their PhD in programming it. It's designed for them. The iPad face has eyes on it, and they've designed it so that when the eyes look a certain direction, that's sort of a subtle indicator to the people who are working alongside it that the robot is probably going to reach that way. So they've thought about all the different ways that humans and robots might start interacting.
Mike Javin, again, editor at thebusinessofrobotics.com. Here's another brief excerpt of a film made by Will Smith, iRobot.
My father tried to teach me human emotions. They are difficult.
You mean you're a designer?
Yes.
Elizabeth Croft is professor at the University of British Columbia, where she's the director of the Collaborative Advanced Robotics and Intelligence Systems Lab. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Are we going to be talking to robots like that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of work already being done in terms of speech recognition, and that whether we're really going to have robots with emotions or robots that fulfill our expectations of what their behavior should be, you know, that's, I think, where we can talk about it's really about what we expect from the robot and having that reflected by the behavior of the robot.
Before we get to the emotions, tell us a bit about what you've researched in terms of what we do expect from robots and how they work best in terms of, for example, we just heard that the face, the iPod face, yep, on Baxter has eyes, and when the eyes move, it tells you what it's going to do. Is that comforting?
Well, I think it's helpful. So what we're looking here at the University of British Columbia is how people and robots work together, and one of the areas that we're actually looking at is factory automation. And so if you have a robot working side by side with a person on an assembly manufacturing task, knowing where the robot is going to move or what its next action is going to be through basic cues that you would see when you were working with somebody else. You could see what they were about to do, and you could determine that. You could observe it and just know, oh, they're going to move over there now, or they're reaching for that item right now, so I'm not going to reach for it. Having the robot have those same social cues, we find actually makes the interaction faster. So we, for example, ran a series of experiments where we were having the robot handing over an object. And by having the robot establish what we call shared attention, that the robot looks at the handover location and before it reaches that position, actually results in the person taking the object faster. And so it speeds up the interaction, even though what people liked better was actually having the robot look up and engage them, look at in their eyes. The people liked that better, but what actually made them work faster was establishing shared attention around the object.
So is there an effort then to develop robots that you can look in the eye?
There's a number of different efforts to just like human-computer interaction with human-robot interaction, make the robot's behavior and interaction such that it is more comfortable to work with. That's one thing, to have that engagement, but also to make it more productive to work with.
How soon do you think we will have robots at home?
Oh, that's a good question. Some people have them already. They're called Roombas, and they're cleaning my floor right now. So that's one thing. I think this is an evolution. I think the Baxter that's already been discussed shows that the cost of a robot that can assist you is getting down to the same price as, you know, a small car. Basically, you are getting into that sort of price range. And when robotics are shown to be useful and helpful and in a price range that people can afford, we're going to see more of them in home. There are already sort of forays into that. Philips has an elder assistant robot called iCat, and there's been a number of robots developed, for example, Perro the seal robot in nursing homes. So there's already forays of robots coming into our homes and into our environments, and I think that's just going to grow.
Elizabeth Croft at the University of British Columbia. Back to Mike Davin at thebusinessofrobotics.com. If the thing that vacuums your floor is a robot, I would have called it an appliance. How do you define robot?
Well, there's a lot of definitions for it. No one can quite agree. And I think what happens is something that we initially might call a robot over time sort of becomes into that appliance category. We no longer think of it as a robot. So, you know, is Siri on my iPhone a robot? In a way it is, and maybe in another way you just think of it as a tool. So there's not really one good definition of what a robot is, but those types of technologies, the sensors and the artificial intelligence behind them are going to drive a whole host of different technologies that we start to experience.
We know, of course, from the Star Wars movies that there are different kinds and different species of robots.
What do you mean, broken? Well, fix it then, you stupid bucket. Really, machines are so unreliable. Oh, well done, R2. I knew you could do it.
Kevin Kelly, senior maverick at Wired and author of Cool Tools, A Catalog of Possibilities. Never talked to a senior maverick before. Kevin Kelly, good to have you on our program.
Great to be here.
Tell us a little more about the differences between robots. Are they as dramatic as the ones between C-3PO and R2-D2?
Well, basically, robots are things that we can't have. And as the other fellow was describing, we kind of redefine robots as they come along into appliances once they arrive. And so, like AI, it will always be something that's in the future. Once it's arrived here, it becomes another tool that we use.
So tell us more, then, about the kinds of tools that we are likely to have in our future.
Well, they are getting smarter, and in some cases, they'll look more humanoid, but for every humanoid-looking robot, there'll be 100 other species that resemble, you know, arms or whose bodies we don't even see. Or they'll be like a self-driving car. They'll have the body of a car, and they'll drive around. And so most of the work that we want these machines to do are actually jobs that humans don't do very well, and so there's no reason why they should look like humans. While there are occasional jobs that we want them to do that are like humans, most of the things we want them to do, they'll do better not looking like humans.
I thought, well, we heard earlier from Mike Davin that it's good if you have a humanoid-type robot because it can use the same tools and manipulate things in the same way that people can. Isn't that important if they have to do human functions under adverse conditions, for example, when there's a nuclear power plant disaster?
Yes, that's a very specialized need, but most of the reasons why we want to make machines are to do things like move cans of soup at 5,000 miles an hour down an assembly line. So we want them to work much faster than humans, so they won't look like humans. Or we want them to drive a car, drive us around, and there's no reason why they need to look like humans. There's no reason to have a robot sit in the car. The car itself could just be a robot. So I think the times when we want a humanoid robot are going to be very few. Most of the time we want them to be other species of machines.
What about emotional involvement with robots, and how likely are people to get involved with their robots?
I actually think that we're going to have emotional machines before we have thinking machines. Emotion is a much more primitive set of facilities, and so we have pets, which are not conscious and have various levels of smartness, but are incredibly emotional. And so a better analog might be thinking about these machines as pets. And so we will love them, and they will love us back long before they're ever conscious or as smart as we are.
Elizabeth Croft, love us back?
Well, I actually do agree that the emotion piece is maybe not easier, but it's something that's projected by us. And so I think that, you know, some people love their computers and their iPhones already, and they put in, I don't want to go back to thinking about Clippy and these types of interactions that we had with devices, but we do have already these interactions with our personal devices.
Okay.
We love our cars.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a very brief break. Later on today's Talking Point, the Waldorf method from Europe makes an appearance in the schools of China. In a moment, back with this conversation on To The Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warman, only back with To The Point. You're talking today about robots, however you might define them. Are they tools? Are they appliances? Do they, in fact, have emotions? Do we have an emotional relationship with them? Here's a segment from Her, the new film by Spike Jonze. In this clip, Joaquin Phoenix is talking to his operating system, which is voiced by Scarlett Johansson.
What's it like to be alive in that room right now?
I wish I could put my arms around you. I wish I could touch you.
How would you touch me?
Good question. Since she is an operating system, Elizabeth Croft, back to you. What about this? How is it that we will attribute emotion to an operating system?
Well, we like to personify things, and it's somewhat of a human nature. We do this with, as mentioned before, we do this with animals, and we do this with our stuff. And I think this is just our belongings in some ways become an extension of ourselves, and when we express those emotions on them, then if we have something that reflects back to us what we want or what we care about or supports our emotional persona, then we become even more attached to it. And we do see, I see my grad students becoming very attached to particular robots. All my robots in my lab now have names because they've been named by graduate students. And they seem to even put personalities onto these robots. So it is an extension of what we do. But I do see that once we have that robot have some kind of personalization, just the same way that our computers and our devices have personalization, then we develop even a tighter bond with these devices. And that can be very useful because if that robot is helpful to us and engages us, we actually tend to be more productive because we like working with it.
Kevin Kelly, senior maverick at Wired, author of Cool Tools, A Catalog of Possibilities, back to you. If the robots start taking our jobs, are we going to get mad at them?
No, actually, I think the best strategy for working with the coming workforce of robots is to learn how to work with them well. I think people who are taught how to work with robots well will do better than those who refuse to. And I think learning how to work with machines, whether they're disembodied AIs or whether they're embodied in, you know, mechanical apparatus, is going to be one of the key techno-literacies of the future.
Kevin Kelly again at Wired. Ron Arkin is with us, Regents Professor in the School of Interactive Computing and the director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory. Good to have you on our program as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Tell us, if you will, about this business of learning how to work with machines. And are we going to have to concoct a whole new code of behavior to govern this?
Well, I'm not sure it's such a question of working with machines in the sense that you're describing. What we need to understand are the ethical consequences and the social implications of the technology that we're creating. We are moving ahead at a relatively breakneck pace. And the real question is, do we fully understand the consequences of the impact that this technology is going to have? We can see it in warfare. We can see a major debate is going on internationally right now about the use of lethal autonomous robotic systems. We can see the questions raised even in the movies, such as you mentioned Her, and many others in times past, ranging from Blade Runner and others as well, too, to the notions of developing attachments to robotic artifacts. And what if they perform, for example, ultimately, not now, but ultimately in ways that are superior to human beings? What impact is going to have that have on our society? And what kinds of rules and regulations should we potentially as a community develop to regulate our own research?
Even before they get smarter than we are, what about the situation where the robot does something that adversely affects somebody else? What about the issue of who's responsible?
Responsibility is a very, very important point. Right now, there's a question in autonomy, and there is, in a philosophical sense, autonomy basically implies that you are responsible for your actions. Roboticists typically use the phrase autonomous robots in a different way. We're just talking about the ability to make decision-making. Ultimately, at any time until the so-called singularity, where machine intelligence exceeds human intelligence, if indeed it does occur, happens, responsibility always vests within human beings. And the hard part is defining out where in the chain of the creation of these artifacts or the use of these artifacts that the responsibility ultimately vests.
Describe the chain, if you can, in a hypothetical way, and the various places where there might be responsibility and accountability required.
Okay, well, let's talk about in a military situation. Suppose you have a so-called autonomous platform and it inadvertently kills a civilian, for example, whose fault is that at this particular point in time? Is it the designer of the robot? Perhaps, if they knowingly created a design that was faulty and was allowed to move forward. Is it the manufacturer of the robot? Did they allow tolerances to be escape from the manufacturing facility that were totally unacceptable? Is it the commander in the field who may have known that these systems were prone to malfunction and continued to use them? Or was it the operator, the actual individual who was the last one in the so-called kill chain in this particular case, who deployed the particular system and may have tasked it in an inappropriate way? Somewhere where these errors and mistakes occur, a human being must be found responsible.
So you don't think there'll ever be a time then, unless the intelligence of the robot becomes superior to humans, when the robot will be found accountable. But what about that moment, if in fact that should happen? In what way would robotic intelligence be superior to human intelligence, and how would you hold a robot accountable?
Well, again, I am not a futurist in that particular sense. I'm a roboticist. And there are many who speculate about the notions of sentient beings that could be created, which mostly are philosophers at this particular point in time, although there are a few roboticists who indeed step into that particular domain. The question is, one, can it be achieved? And there's other subsidiary questions related to that. Should robots be given rights, not akin perhaps to animals or businesses or others as well, too? Should they have the right to certain protections and decisions that we already afford non-human actors as well? There's an extensive body of work going on in the legal community and the philosophical community that address that. But I'm a roboticist. I'm interested in building intelligent machines at this point in time, none of which I expect to become sentient anytime soon.
Ron Arkin, a director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory at the University of Georgia. Kevin Kelly, back to you. You're a senior maverick at Wired, and I'm wondering if you have given some thought to this, and what about the issue of whether robots should have rights?
I think they certainly will accumulate rights as we go along, as you say, just as animals have accumulated some, we've given them or honored certain rights that they have, and over time our circle of empathy seems to increase, and we historically have been assigning more rights to certain animals as they seem to be able to suffer, as we understand that they can suffer pain or be sentient. And I think the same will happen with the machines that we make. They will never be necessarily out of complete autonomy, in the sense that all things have shared autonomy. So you went through the list of possible ways of someone who could be responsible in a kill chain, but it's not a binary decision of one agency or another. There can be shared responsibilities, and we even have that today. So the legal issues, I think, will resolve. What's coming is the fact that they will become more powerful over time. They will accumulate more powers of thinking. And what we call intelligence right now, we think of it as a single dimension, as a single vector. But it's actually many, many, many things all bundled up. And some of these machines will have some of those vectors and some of those dimensions, and others will have a different kind of thinking and a different way of doing things, and have a different set of rights and responsibilities. And I think those two will always go together. You can't have responsibilities without having rights, and you can't have the rights without having responsibilities. And I think just as we teach our children to grow up and we train them to both have rights and responsibilities, we can also train our machines in the same way.
So, Ron Arkin, back to you at Georgia Tech. Excuse me for getting it wrong the first time.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Of course. You talked about the speed of the development of robotics. You are a roboticist. You don't want to be a legislator here. But how soon are we going to really have to confront this question of the ethics of dealing with robotics?
There are ethical questions which need to be confronted right now. The United Nations the Human Rights Council has already called for a moratorium on certain kinds of lethal autonomous robotic platforms. Human Rights Watch has already called for a ban on similar types of platforms. The Department of Defense of our nation has already mandated restrictions on the development and deployment of certain kinds of platforms. So this is something that's happening right now in terms of the military domain. The secondary domain are those robots such as Elizabeth and others were talking about, those that we form an affective bond with. The potential for intimacy and other ways in which we can relate to these things that can potentially supplant and change human-human relationships needs to be considered. It's not as immediate as the warfare one, but indeed we need to pay attention to that. The issues of unemployment and the impact on employment are always important as well, too, and that's happening now as we speak. What happens to workers that are displaced by this particular technology? There was a recent book by two MIT professors who really put a clarion call for paying attention to this. Others, including those in Georgia Tech, have said that there will be new jobs that are created to replace those old jobs, but we still have to have clear migration paths to do that. Privacy issues of drones, you already heard about people, towns ready to authorize laws to shoot drones out of the sky. All sorts of things are happening right now, and it's important to consider what this technology can bring to us. And I always ask my colleagues, what if we succeed in doing what we're trying to accomplish? What if we actually create these intelligent machines, perhaps even sentient machines? How will that change the world? Will it change it in a better way, or will it create a dystopia? These are questions that not just one roboticist, but an entire community, and that's not just community of roboticists, but theologians, philosophers, social scientists, politicians, everyone needs to come to the table and consider. But as I mentioned, the military ones are the most pressing right now.
Back to Elizabeth Croft at the University of British Columbia. What about these ones that we have an affective bond with? And have you thought about the ethical issues involved?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is – Ron's making a very important point here. And although I do agree with him that the military issue is the key and core and urgent issue that we have to deal with. But certainly we have to be concerned about what the impacts are of having supportive robots in our life. If we create a robot that is used to help somebody in a nursing home, right, for example, paro robots that are given to older people who have dementia, that are suffering dementia, that means that there's one of the reasons for doing that is to reduce caregiver time. So are we making good trades there? And we have to ask those questions. Again, I'm a roboticist, not an ethicist, but I do think that we have to be raising the flag about, yes, we are creating this technology, and yes, it is going to have impacts on our society. On the other side, though, as nations in Canada and the U.S., we do need to make sure that we are at the front of the curve in terms of the technology that we are developing for our workforce, because we have to have a workforce that is much more productive to be able to create the wages that our workforce needs. So if we turn a blind eye to the productivity enhancements that robotics can provide for our workplaces, we're shooting ourselves in the foot, and we need to move ahead on that.
Quickly back to Mike Davin, you're editor of The Business of Robotics. Are the companies that manufacture robotics and make money on robots thinking about these issues too?
Oh, absolutely. And one other area I would mention is that we need to be confronting right now is with self-driving cars. That's a technology that's very close, but the implications of who's at fault when a self-driving car runs into another self-driving car or runs into a person are things that we need to start confronting right away. So I agree that there's a lot of issues being brought up by this technology that's moving very quickly and that are not future issues to be looking at 5 or 10 years. They can be started looking at right now.
Professor Croft said it's important that we move as quickly as we can in order to be competitive. Japan is ahead of the United States, so are other countries in terms of robotics, as I understand it. How are they dealing with these issues? We don't have time to go into that in detail, but presumably they're confronted with them even more immediately than we are.
Well, yeah, they and I think they have a different attitude in some of those other countries towards robotics. And so that's a great point that was made, that we need to be aware of what they're doing, and we need to keep pace with them, because I think in other countries like Japan, there's a higher ratio of robots to people in the factories, and they're more efficient, and you know, we're competing against that. So we have to look at it, and we have to ask all these questions, but we certainly need to continue to move forward and you know, lead in this area.
And Kevin Kelly, back to you at Wired. You're author of Cool Tools, A Catalog of Possibilities. Are robots going to become emotional tools, sexual tools, if you will? Is that already happening? And if it does, to the extent that it does, is that going to offer special challenges in terms of ethics?
I think it's, as the other speakers have said, we're entering into this terra incognita of incredible questions and mysteries and dilemmas and paradoxes as we make these things that are like us. And that's what we're trying to do eventually, is we want to make other kind of beings that can walk around. And so we have all the kind of spiritual, religious, ethical dilemmas that have ever been with us. They're going to be 1,000 times greater and more intense as we do this. And it doesn't matter whether it's emotional, intellectual, sexual, criminal. They're all coming in a much more high-powered way. And each one of these things, as we try and answer, also redefines us as humans. I mean, one of the things the robots keep doing is forcing us to redefine who we are. Why are we here? What do we do? And what's our role? And so that's actually an equal challenge. Just as we're trying to figure out what their role is, we're having to redefine what our role in the cosmos is.
Well, thank you all very, very much for a very interesting conversation. Kevin Kelly, once again, is senior maverick at Wired. He's author of Cool Tools, A Catalog of Possibilities. Elizabeth Croft is professor at the University of British Columbia. She's director of the Collaborative Advanced Robotics and Intelligent Systems Lab. Mike Davin is editor at thebusinessofrobotics.com. And Ron Arkin is Regents Professor in the School of Interactive Computing and director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Good to have all of you on our program. I hope you'll all come back in the future. For almost 100 years, European and American parents looking for an alternative arts-based education for their children have embraced the principles of Waldorf schools. They were developed in 1919 by an obscure Austrian mystic, Rudolf Steiner. Now, the movement is catching on in a place famous for routine, highly structured learning, China. We'll hear more in a moment on To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Olney back with today's Talking Point. After taking power in 1949, China's communist government eliminated illiteracy in that vast country. That was a historic accomplishment. But now, education is one of China's biggest problems. There is an intellectual backlash against rote memorization and the pressure to perform on exams that determine the course of a child's life. More and more parents are embracing the Waldorf education, a European method that emphasizes the love of learning. That's been reported in the New Yorker magazine. The author is Ian Johnson. He joins us now from Beijing. Welcome to our program.
Hi, nice to be on.
Tell us a bit more about what it is about education as practiced now in China that at least some of the people are rebelling against.
Well, right now the system focuses heavily on rote memorization. Children go to school for a very long time each day, even starting in elementary school. They have hours and hours of homework. And they, even on their during their vacation time, they have often projects to do, very involved and take hours and hours of work. So they never really have any time to play or have fun. And this is something that a lot of parents are reacting against.
Sounds like the tiger mom practices that we've heard about in this country.
Well, right. In some ways, I think the two countries are converging somewhere in the middle, because in the U.S., all of these things, standardized tests, for example, are in vogue, and parents are all worried that their kids aren't working hard enough in the States, so people want their, you know, to push their kids to study harder and learn harder. But in China, there's this feeling that this stifles creativity. I think there's this realization that this is not really helpful to an individual's development.
This is true, I take it, even though Chinese children do better than the children in other countries, including this one, on a lot of these standardized tests.
Right. No, a lot of parents tell me we're really good at cranking out test-taking machines. I mean, our kids do amazingly well on tests, and when it comes to cramming individuals full of information and getting them to regurgitate it out on a test, maybe Chinese education is second to none. But the question maybe is, in the longer run, what does that do for the individual, and does that really even help society all that much?
So what are some of the alternatives, then, that parents concerned about that are now looking for?
There are a few systems that are popular. In kindergarten and elementary, there's the Montessori system, which started in Italy about 100 years ago. And then the biggest in China right now is the Waldorf system, which started in the German-speaking world around the same time as a reaction to the authoritarianism in that area of society just before and after World War I. And it emphasizes letting children have more autonomy, free time, playing, but sort of structured playing so that they're learning at the same time.
And how is that catching on in a place which has been governed by this very standardized sort of mechanistic approach in the recent past?
Well, it's catching on really quickly. One of the challenges in China for alternative education is that the government insists on setting the curriculum for grades 1 to 9, and there's almost no private education in that area, in that time frame for a child. So most of these schools are illegal, and I think it shows just how desperate parents are to find an alternative for their child, that they're willing to send them to what amount to illegal schools so they don't have to go to the state system.
Do they send them to both the state and the illegal schools, or avoid the state system altogether?
Oh, they avoid it altogether. Typically what happens is they send their children to Waldorf kindergartens, which are not, that phase of kindergarten is not regulated by the state. And then when the child graduates and is set to go into elementary school, they say, let's just add a grade 1. And then they hire a teacher or two, and then the next year they add a grade 2 and a grade 3 and so on. And right now we're at the point where a high school is being formed, a Waldorf high school. So there is this real demand by parents for something different, for giving their children something other than the state-mandated education.
You went to a place called Chengdu where there's a Waldorf school. Why has it caught on in that particular place?
Well, Chengdu is kind of like the San Francisco of China. It is a more relaxed, open, freewheeling place. It's far away from the political system, the political center in Beijing. It historically has been more of an independent area. It's geographically sort of cut off from the rest of the country. It's tolerant of alternative lifestyles. And I think it's not really a coincidence that it started there.
And what did you find? What were the kids up to, and at what stage were they? Have they gone all the way through high school there?
They're starting grade 9 this coming autumn. So high school will start in the autumn. But what I found there, okay, so there's a school, and it has a different education system, and it's more freewheeling, and it isn't as straight-laced. But also around the school is this subculture. It's almost like a hippie haven of parents who have gone and taken over old farmhouses and are engaging in organic agriculture and trying to explore different ways of living that are not so, say, goal-oriented as traditional society.
How risky is this for them in terms of the possible reaction from the state? How risky is it for their children if they're educated in such a way that they don't do so well on all those standardized tests?
Right. I think the biggest risk is for the children. If they, for example, go through the high school and it's not recognized by the state, then they're not going to be able to get into colleges. Now, for the wealthy parents, they'll say, fine, I'll just send my kid abroad to the United States or Canada or Australia, and they'll get a college education there. But for the middle class people, it's really challenging. I think what they probably feel is that the government also recognizes that the current system needs reform, and that one way or another, this will be it will be okayed by the government, or they'll somehow it will become accepted. But there is certainly a real risk for the children's future.
Tell us a bit more about what you actually saw at the school in Chengdu.
Well, the school has, okay, 8 grades and a big, big kindergarten. It's got over 300 children altogether. It's built on this former fish farm, and so it's got this pond in the middle, and they've greenified it and put in a bamboo grove, and you see children playing outside a lot. And when you first go to a Waldorf school, it looks unstructured. It looks like they're just having fun the whole time, but actually a lot of the playing has a pedagogical function. And so the children were playing often under a bit of supervision from the teachers. I saw them in the classroom learning traditional Chinese myths and legends. They were performing skits, and the teachers were reciting verses on with the drum accompanying themselves as if they were a shaman or something like that. And it was lively and quite different from the public schools that I've seen in China.
So it's not a threat, then, to the current system, either locally or nationally. And as you indicated, maybe it'll catch on a broader basis and the government will begin to make changes.
Yeah, I don't think it's a direct political threat. I think what it really does is it creates stronger individuals, and it doesn't create people who are quite so, say, hierarchically obedient. So in the long term, that will change China, but it's not as if you're creating dissidents who are going to be out protesting in the downtown area for democracy tomorrow. But it does create people who have more ability to think for themselves. And I think maybe in the long run, that could change things in China.
Well, thank you very much for that report and for your insight. It's great to talk with you. Ian Johnson joining us from Beijing. He's with the New Yorker magazine. Great to have you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.